Lindsay with your worldwide news update. Ousted Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said he had no plans to leave the country after the fall of Damascus a week ago, but the Russian military evacuated him after their base in western Syria came under attack. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
A statement published on Monday on the Syrian presidency's Telegram channel was posted from Moscow, where Assad has been granted asylum. It said he wanted to address distortions given during a critical juncture in the nation's history, and at no point did he consider stepping down, seeking refuge, or did he receive a proposal from an individual party. He was ousted after insurgent forces led by the Islamist Hayat Tahrir al-Sham swept through Syria in a lightning offensive, ending more than 50 years of iron-fisted rule by his family. Assad wrote that he left Damascus to manage combat operations from Humayman base in Latakia on December 8, but after it came under drone attack, Moscow requested the base's command arrange an immediate evacuation to Russia. President Vladimir Putin made the decision to grant Assad asylum in Russia, which deployed its air force to Syria in 2015 to help him repel rebel forces.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. Ukraine's military intelligence agency and U.S. military officials say some North Korean troops have been killed during combat against Ukrainian forces in Russia's Kursk border region. These are the first reported casualties since the U.S. and Ukraine announced North Korea had sent 10,000 to 12,000 troops to Russia to help it in the almost three-year war. The Ukrainian agency said Monday that around 30 North Korean troops were killed or wounded over the weekend during battle in Kursk, where Russia has for months been trying to quash a Ukrainian incursion. This is VOA News. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump on Monday held his first news conference since winning last month's election. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
From considering a pardon for New York's embattled mayor to suspected drone sightings in the eastern U.S.
Our military knows and our president knows. And for some reason, they want to keep people in suspense.
Trump backed his pick, a prominent vaccine skeptic, Robert Kennedy, for health secretary.
He's going to be much less radical than you would think.
And vowed to preserve access to a key vaccine.
You're not going to lose the polio vaccine. That's not going to happen.
He's calling on President Biden to stop following Congress's directive to sell unused border wall parts.
It's almost a criminal act.
Threatening more defamation suits against media organizations.
Is very corrupt.
And defending trade proposals many economists say would hurt Americans.
Tariffs will make our country rich.
On the Middle East,
we had a very good talk
with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu about ending the Gaza war. But as for Russia and Ukraine,
I see that as more difficult.
Backing off earlier promises to end the fighting before even taking office. Sagar Magani, Washington.
TikTok on Monday asked the U.S. Supreme Court to step in on an emergency basis to block the federal law that would ban the popular platform in the United States unless its China-based parent company agreed to sell it. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Lawyers for the company and China-based ByteDance urged the justices to step in before the law's Thursday deadline. President-elect Donald Trump was asked if he will keep his pledge to save the platform.
You know, I have a warm spot in my heart for TikTok because I won youth by 34 points.
If the ban takes effect, it would expose app stores that offer TikTok and internet hosting services that support it to potential fines. Norman Hall, Washington.
Canada's finance minister quit on Monday, dealing another major political blow to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's already unpopular government. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reports.
Chrystia Freeland said in a stinging resignation letter that she was quitting in the wake of a meeting last Friday with Trudeau, who had asked her to take on a lesser post after the two had argued for weeks over spending. In a letter posted to social media, Freeland said the possibility of new U.S. tariffs represented a grave threat. She joins a wave of cabinet ministers who have either already quit or announced they won't run in the next election.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Israel takes over a buffer zone along the Golan Heights.
Israel says it has no intention of staying in the buffer zone permanently, but wants to make sure the residents near the border are safe.
What does Kim Jong-un have in store for Donald Trump?
Kim Jong-un believes he has a stronger hand, and I believe part of that stronger hand is his newfound relationship with the Russians.
And President Joe Biden granted clemency to 37 people facing execution in federal prison.
He was really reflecting on his faith and his belief system and weighing that against the severity of the crimes.
Today is Tuesday, December 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Steve Karish in Washington. We begin today's show in the Middle East. Israel has taken over a buffer zone on its border with Syria and says its forces will not withdraw until it's sure that residents of the Golan Heights border area will be secure. Half of these residents are from the Druze community, who worry about what the fall of the Bashar al-Assad regime will mean for themselves and their family members on the Syrian side of the border. Linda Gradstein and Ricky Rosen report from the Golan Heights.
The majority of the some 20,000 Druze residents on the Israeli side of the Golan Heights welcomed the fall of the Assad regime. The Golan Druze are an Arabic-speaking religious minority, most of whom consider themselves to be Syrian citizens and have extended family on the Syrian side of the border. Many, like Druze social activist Nabih al-Halabi, say they hope for a new democratic regime in Syria which will make peace with Israel.
I will stay in my house. I will not leave my house if it's Israeli regime or Syrian regime. But we hope and we believe, I believe personally, that in the next few years, Israel and Syria will be more close to make a peace agreement and real agreement.
The long Syrian civil war and the current situation of social and economic uncertainty have pushed young Druze in the Golan Heights into identifying more with Israel, according to Dolan Abu Salah, the mayor of Majdal Shems, the largest Druze town in the Golan. He has worked as an Israeli local official for 16 years.
Since the fall of Assad, we have experienced people here getting closer to Israel. The one who has proven that it can ensure security and human rights, especially for those living adjacent to the border, is the state of Israel. It is the stable factor here.
Others in the Druze community say they worry about the rebels now leading Syria, who were previously associated with Islamic fundamentalist groups. They fear that the rebels will not be as tolerant of the Druze minority as was the former secular leader Bashar al-Assad. Atta Farhat is a Druze journalist.
First, let them cut off their beards and tone down their Islam. After that, I will agree that they will take charge of Syria.
The intentions of the Islamic fundamentalist rebel groups now leading Syria also worry Israel. Immediately after Assad fled, the Israeli army moved into the buffer zone between the Israeli side of the Golan Heights, which Israel occupied in 1967 and later annexed, and the Syrian side. Israel says it has no intention of staying in the buffer zone permanently, but wants to make sure the residents near the border are safe. Stefan Cohen is the former commander of the IDF liaison unit to UN forces in Syria and Lebanon.
We cannot judge because, you know, the regime collapsed just on the 8th of December. So that's just the, you know, in the short term, it looks stable. But we don't know what will happen in the next few weeks and months.
The rebel leader and de facto ruler of Syria today, Ahmed Ashara, says that Syria is exhausted by war and wants peace with everyone, including Israel. After more than a year of war against Hamas and Hezbollah, Israel too is exhausted. But both sides are waiting to see what happens next in Syria. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, on the Israel-Syria border.
Matt Gaetz was a U.S. representative from Florida before President-elect Donald Trump picked him to be the U.S. Attorney General and run the country's Department of Justice. At the same time, Gaetz was also under investigation by the House Ethics Committee for alleged sexual misconduct and illegal drug use. On Monday, the committee's findings were made public. Jillian Kitchener of Reuters has more.
Former Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz paid tens of thousands of dollars to women for drugs and sex, including with a 17-year-old girl. That's according to media reports, citing the final draft of a House Ethics Committee report. Gaetz has denied wrongdoing, and in trying to prevent the report's release, he filed a lawsuit against the ethics panel, saying damage to his reputation and professional standing would be severe and irreversible. The three-term congressman had resigned from the House of Representatives last month after he was selected by President-elect Donald Trump to be Attorney General. He withdrew from consideration in the face of an uphill confirmation battle in the Senate. According to CBS News, the report found that Gaetz paid more than $90,000 to 12 different women. Those payments, the ethics panel determined, were likely in connection with sexual activity and drug use. Reuters was not immediately able to reach Gaetz for comment.
That's Reuters' Jillian Kitchener reporting for us today. And in Kenya, the government has reported more than 7,000 cases of sexual and gender-based violence since September of last year. The country's interior ministry has established a special security team to deal with the growing violence against women and girls. Mohammed Yusuf has the story, narrated for us by Scott Walterman.
Kenya's security report this year has been dominated by the violence and killings of women and girls at the hands of their family members, neighbors, and others. According to authorities, there have been more than 7,100 cases of gender-based violence since September 2023. Sarah Wambui says she was violently attacked one Thursday morning. The 40-year-old left her husband of 20 years after he violently abused her. Her husband did not take her departure lightly.
He attacked me on 18 January 2024 and he stabbed me all over. But he stabs from my face, the entire body, even my internal organs, my kidney and my liver were affected. I've been in hospital, I was just discharged in August.
Speaking last week, Foreign Affairs Minister and Acting Interior Minister Musalia Mudavadi said the number of incidents of sexual and gender-based violence against women worries security officers.
Nairobi County recorded the highest number of SGBV cases, while Samburu and Mandera counties had the lowest incidents. There are 100 murders of women from August to November 2024. So far, the Directorate of Criminal Investigations has completed investigations on these, and the majority are pending before court.
2 weeks ago, hundreds of people took to the streets in Nairobi demanding an end to the killing of women, though the protest was dispersed by police using tear gas and making arrests. The police handling of protesters angered the demonstrators, human rights groups, and women's organizations. They accused authorities of not taking the attacks and killing of women seriously. Wambui's accused attacker is out of prison and has been threatening to kill her, she says. The mother of two has been moving from one place to another to avoid him.
Right now, my life is in danger because the perpetrator is out. Yeah, he's out and he has vowed that if he finish me off, the case will be kind of discarded. So I'm actually in hiding.
Human rights researchers say patriarchal views and a lack of protection are some of the reasons behind the attacks on women and girls. Najoki Kashanga is a human rights defender. She says the number of abused women might even be higher than reported.
Most of those numbers come from, you know, low-income areas where there's just a lot of poverty, and that is linked to a lot of violence. So these numbers might sound staggering, but for people who are on the ground documenting these cases on a daily basis, we know that there are even more people who have not even been covered by those who made the headlines. And this is a catastrophe that must be addressed by the government.
According to the Gender Violence Recovery Center, one in three Kenyan women have experienced sexual violence before the age of 18. 38% of married women have experienced physical violence. The government has set up a security team to address attacks on women and ensure justice for the victims. Meanwhile, while many women and mothers prepare to celebrate Christmas with their families, Wambui will be moving from place to place, just trying to stay alive. For Mohammed Yusuf in Nairobi, I'm Scott Walterman, VOA News.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. President-elect Trump is renewing calls he made during his first term for the U.S. to buy Greenland, which is a Danish territory. Trump posted on social media Sunday, "For purposes of national security and freedom throughout the world, the United States of America feels that the ownership and control of Greenland is an absolute necessity." Greenland says it's not for sale, and Trump's initial calls to purchase it in 2019 came to nothing. The president-elect's latest suggestion comes after he also suggested the U.S. could retake control of the Panama Canal. Japanese automakers Honda and Nissan announced Monday that they had agreed to explore a merger. They also said that smaller Nissan Alliance member Mitsubishi Motors had agreed to join the talks on integrating their businesses. The consolidation would create the third largest auto group by vehicle sales after Toyota and Volkswagen. Embattled Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is not expected to announce a decision on his future over the Christmas holidays. This, as concerns about Trudeau's leadership were exacerbated last week when his finance minister and deputy prime minister abruptly resigned from the cabinet. A growing number of Liberal members of parliament want Trudeau to step aside, fearing the party is headed for a historic defeat. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. In his first term as U.S. president, Donald Trump tightened economic sanctions against North Korea to try to force Pyongyang to give up its nuclear weapons program. In this report by VOA's Young-Yo Kim and narrated by Scott Stearns, we look at what Trump should expect from North Korea this time around.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un used a military exhibition for his first remarks on the United States since Donald Trump became president-elect, saying past negotiations confirmed what he called Washington's unchangeable hostility toward Pyongyang. Kim vowed to expand North Korea's nuclear capabilities without limit as the only way to counter external threats. Kim today is a decidedly different opponent for Trump than when they last met in 2019, says former State Department Asian Affairs official Evans Revere.
Kim Jong-un believes he has a stronger hand, and I believe part of that stronger hand is his newfound relationship with the Russians.
U.S. military officials say there are now more than 10,000 North Korean troops in Russia helping with its invasion of Ukraine. Russian Defense Minister Andrei Belousov was in Pyongyang last month advancing a strategic partnership treaty that Belousov says reduces the risk of war on the Korean Peninsula. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte says that alliance is a challenge for the incoming Trump administration.
A nuclear technology, a missile technology is flowing into North Korea and therefore is a risk now that North Korea will use it not only to be a threat to us here but also to the U.S. mainland.
Together, Russia and North Korea threaten greater instability, says former U.S. National Intelligence Officer for North Korea, Sidney Seiler.
This is becoming a military alliance with both near-term and longer-term dangerous risk to obviously extending the war in Ukraine, destabilizing the Korean Peninsula, and just destabilizing the international community.
With North Korea gaining Russian air defense systems, upgraded munitions manufacturing, cash, and food and fuel aid, Seiler says Kim has less need for Washington than during Trump's first term.
With all the things that Kim Jong-un is able to get from his new best friend, Vladimir Putin, why would he reach out to Donald Trump?
In his first term, Trump worked with South Korean leaders to try to roll back North Korea's nuclear weapons program. In his second term, Trump will be dealing with a North Korea that has firmly closed the door on denuclearization, says Revere.
What the North Koreans have been after all the while is to gain acceptance from the United States, or at least acknowledgement from the United States, that North Korea is a legitimate, accepted nuclear power now, and that the two countries should sit down together and talk and coexist with each other.
Just days before last month's U.S. election, North Korea tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile that could potentially reach most of the U.S. mainland. For Young-gil Kim, Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Elsewhere in Asia, ties between India and China thawed in 2024, with both sides pulling back some troops from flashpoints along their border. But analysts say mistrust between the Asian giants will pose a challenge to restoration of friendly ties. Analysts also believe the Indochina rapprochement will not affect India's strategic cooperation with the United States. From New Delhi, Anjana Pasricha has more.
After Indian and Chinese troops withdrew from two flashpoints along their disputed Himalayan border, the Indian foreign minister told parliament that ties were set in the direction of some improvement, but he stressed the need for stability on their frontier.
We are clear that the maintenance of peace and tranquility in border areas is a prerequisite for the development of our ties.
While troops may have stepped back from eye-to-eye confrontation, tens of thousands of soldiers are still spending a fifth winter in the Himalayas. High-level diplomatic dialogue has resumed after the first bilateral meeting in 5 years between the Indian and Chinese leaders in October diffused tensions that had escalated following the 2020 border skirmish. China has said it is ready to work with India to, quote, enhance mutual trust. But New Delhi will be cautious, analysts say.
Border and border-related issues is something that India wants to address first and then expand into overall larger normalization of relationship with China.
Economic cooperation could move faster. China wants to tap into India's growing markets, while New Delhi needs more Chinese imports as it seeks to become a manufacturing hub. The Chinese foreign minister has asked New Delhi to restore direct flights that were suspended during the pandemic and facilitate visas for Chinese nationals. While bilateral trade has flourished, India has put restrictions on Chinese investments and visas. Harsh Pant is vice president for studies at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi.
The economic ties perhaps will continue to evolve much more in a much more accelerated manner. And perhaps India would be much more liberal in sort of opening up its markets or opening up certain sectors.
Pant says the thaw between India and China will not impact New Delhi's ties with Washington, which have grown closer, partly over concerns about Beijing's assertiveness. Besides its Himalayan border, New Delhi is also concerned about China's growing presence in the Indian Ocean.
You also have this sense that both India and the U.S. want a certain kind of an Indo-Pacific, a certain kind of this geography, strategic geography, which is free, balanced, open and fair, which is also inclusive. And I think in some ways, those ideas will continue to propel the relationship.
Despite divergences over India's friendly ties with Russia, analysts say Washington will remain a key partner for New Delhi. The Indian foreign minister recently said ties with the U.S. were large and important. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
On Monday, President Joe Biden commuted the sentences of all but three of the 40 people awaiting execution in U.S. federal prisons, citing his long-standing opposition to capital punishment. For a deeper dive, I'm joined by Sandra Babcock, a clinical professor at Cornell Law School and the faculty director and founder of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide.
He just reduced their sentences, so they are no longer sentenced to death. But they are still in prison, and they are, in fact, in prison for life. So a commutation just means a sentence reduction.
One of the big arguments in favor of the death penalty is that it's a deterrent to other criminals, right? Is that argument true? Is the death penalty a deterrent to future crimes?
You know, you'd think it would be, and in fact, the science tells us otherwise. And by science, I mean the social science. People who study this human behavior for a living, criminologists and sociologists that have tried to study and prove that the death penalty acts as a deterrent have concluded that, in fact, there is no evidence that the death penalty deters. So when we think about, you know, what is the purpose of the death penalty, what we're really left with is this idea of vengeance and the idea that, you know, somebody who commits an act of unspeakable violence should themselves be subjected to an act of unspeakable violence.
So looking at vengeance, or some might call it closure, for the families of the victims of these men's crimes, to hear the president lighten their sentences, is it fair for those families to feel some anger, some resentment?
Yeah, you know, I think I wouldn't say that it's unfair for anybody to feel anger or resentment under these circumstances. This is an impossible situation for anybody to be in. And the pain of somebody who has lost a family member or a dear one is unfathomable. What I think is important is that not all victims feel the same way. So there were a number of victims' family members who wrote to President Biden and asked him to commute the death sentences of the people who had, in fact, committed violent acts against their loved ones, saying that the death penalty they felt would not ease their pain. That's probably not true for everybody. I'm sure that there are people who are disappointed by this. But what I would caution against is thinking that every victim wants the same thing.
Getting back to today's actions, we know that President Biden commuted these sentences prior to Trump returning to office. When President Trump was in office previously, his Justice Department executed 13 people, which was a record. So is there any sense that this might have been done to prevent Donald Trump from carrying out these executions? And is it possible for Donald Trump to undo what Joe Biden did today?
It is not possible, as far as I know, for Donald Trump to undo this. It's, you know, that would be unheard of, and I just don't think it's possible. So that is, you know, that's that. It is done. And as to whether it was politically motivated, you know, that's a hard thing to say. I know that President Biden is Catholic. I know that the Pope himself made an appeal to the president to commute the sentences. And the Catholic Church is very strongly opposed to capital punishment. So, you know, if I had to guess, I would guess that faith played a big role in this. And I would also guess that this is something that he has been wrestling with for quite some time. These are not easy decisions by any stretch for anyone. And the fact that he did not commute the death sentences of everyone on death row, but in fact refused to commute the sentences of the three men who had committed mass murder, indicates to me that, you know, that he was really reflecting on his faith and his belief system and weighing that against the severity of the crimes.
And we'll leave it there for today. Sandra Babcock is a clinical professor at Cornell Law School, and she's also the faculty director and founder of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide. Professor Babcock, thanks for being with us tonight.
You are so welcome. Thanks for having me.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karasch.